Okay. You mentioned that when talking about someone harms us, it seems like the only thing to do is to get angry. And I was thinking, well, sometimes I think, well, if I don't get angry, then I'm just sad. Is that just as much of an off?
I guess if I don't get angry,
I get sad.
Oh, okay.
And I'm wondering, is that just as much of an obstacle as the anger?
Yeah, sadness is definitely not as much of an obstacle as anger. It's not a particularly happy feeling, but, you know, something happened that wasn't particularly happy. You know, we don't always have to feel happy. We want to always feel happy, but there's no rule in the universe that says we will or we should. Yeah. I think one thing that's important like that is to really, you know, we're harmed in some way, to really think how much damage is this really causing? Yeah. And in a year or 2 years or five, will it make a difference? And, you know, because many things that we get angry and irritated about are really quite insignificant, but then we build them up to be something so incredibly important. Like the pillow you're sitting on that still hurts. But it's not that important, and it's, you know, it really isn't. So why build things up? So many times we just have a habit of it. You know, anything small happens that we didn't anticipate, we don't like, then we our default method is getting irritated. But it's not, it doesn't make us happy to get irritated, and it's not, it doesn't solve any problems, and it doesn't have any kind of good reason behind it. So why not just drop the situation? Because if you notice, and this will come with mindfulness and phenomena, a phenomena to really watch the kind of thoughts that go on in our mind, and there may be some small thing that happens, and then our mind extrapolates on it and makes it of huge significance. Yeah. And then we get more and more emotional and more upset, and nothing more has happened. Only our mind going like this, making up all sorts of stupid stories. That all star, da 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 da, me. So sometimes when you notice that tendency and habit to do that, you just say, I want to be more careful. And instead of letting my mind write sci-fi movies and horror stories over one sentence that somebody said to me, it just makes more sense to just leave it. Yeah. If you don't add chili to your soup won't get hot in that way. Yeah.
Okay. I do have a question. My name is Jack. Yeah, so my question is, we always expose ourselves that our ultimate goal in this lifetime as a human being is to achieve enlightenment. And at another perspective, there's a very Zen saying in Chinese community, say ignorance is a bliss. 难得糊涂, ignorance is a bliss.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so can you give us some teaching from these two very extreme perspectives.
Ignorance is bliss means that if you pretend to be an ostrich and you stick your head in the sand, then you're not going to see anything you like because you won't see anything. You know, ignorance is bliss, you know, means, okay, it means don't tell me your problems. Don't tell me about bad things in the world. I'm going to pretend nothing else exists and ignore every other living being in this planet, because as soon as I know something, then I experience suffering. Yeah. So ignorance is bliss is a very ignorant way of thinking. Yeah. Okay. What we want to do is be able to see whatever we can, but know how to relate to it and interact with it in a productive way. Yeah. So just ignoring something doesn't, you know, the situation is still there, but we just haven't gained any wisdom, and it kind of percolates underground and, what is it, ferments underground, and then we get more and more unhappy. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Yeah, my mom used to say that ignorance is bliss. So she once told me, you know, if you ever get really ill, don't tell me. Well, thanks, Mom. You know, I can really count on you to help. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
Can you hear? Okay. So let's say someone harms me or says some harmful words to me, and I feel that it has attacked my dignity, yeah. Right? So how do we differentiate or draw the line between dignity and self-worth and self-centeredness? How do I not get trapped into thinking that my dignity is, you know, not my self-centeredness at the end of the day?
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I think our dignity is very related to our honor, you know, and that is very related to what other people think of us. And we are very much captivated and enslaved by our attachment to what other people think about us. Yeah. And that really makes a lot of problems in our life, because if what other people think of us is what is really important, then all of our actions and speech and everything revolves around doing what we think those people think we should do. So we totally give up our freedom. We leave it to others to tell us if we're worth anything or not. And then we just do all sorts of tap dances to try and impress people. Yeah, and we can waste our whole life doing that, and we lose the possibility to really understand ourselves and see, you know, what are our own unique talents that we can explore and cultivate and give to the world. Yeah, because we're so concerned with what other people think. Yeah. And it's really quite interesting to ask ourselves, what is what other people think? Or what is my dignity? Part of it is what I think about myself, which I have control about. I don't have to think about myself the way, same way I think other people think about me. Okay. But if my dignity is what other people think about me, what is that? It's basically just a bunch of other people's thoughts. What are other people's thoughts? What is a thought? Some kind of blip of mental energy that lasts about that long and then goes on to other things. And most people, you know, much to our great disappointment, don't spend their whole life thinking about what they think about us. They're too busy thinking about themselves. Yeah? So really caring about what other people think because we're attached to our reputation, yeah, that's not very worthwhile. In terms of our dignity, you know, our feeling of self-respect, that's something that I think comes from appreciating our good qualities, acting according to our own principles and our own ethical values. Yeah. And our dignity doesn't depend on how other people treat us. Okay? So people can, you can be an oppressed, in an oppressed group, or you could be in a, somebody who's been violated in one way or another. But that doesn't mean we have to start thinking about ourselves as trash. Yeah? We still have our own dignity because, you know, if we're living according to our own values and principles, what other people say doesn't matter. You know, it's when we aren't being true to ourselves that then we start looking outside for approval and reputation. Yeah, and start our tap dance to make everybody think we're wonderful. Does that answer your question? Anything else? In other words, nobody else can take away our dignity. Nobody else can take away our self-respect. Mm-hmm. And other people might think we're garbage. Well, it's a free world. They're entitled to their opinion. Okay. Just because other people think we're garbage doesn't mean we are. I had an interesting situation many years ago when I was living in a monastery in France. And one morning, one nun came to see me and said, you know, you're a very good example of a good nun. You keep your precepts very well, and you're kind, and, you know, this kind of stuff. She praised me. Okay, that's good. Then she left, and about a half an hour later, another nun came and said, you are the worst example of a nun. You don't keep your precepts well at all. You're acting all over the place, you know, just kind of. Okay, so here, within a half an hour, one person tells me I'm very good, and the other person tells me I'm crazy. You know, well, not crazy, but not up to her ideal. Okay, now, if I rely on what other people think to know who I am, then I'm going to be real confused because they're telling me I'm opposite things. Okay. But why do I get confused? Because I'm totally out of touch with what's going on inside here. Yeah. If I'm in touch with what's going on inside here, then, you know, I can evaluate what people say. If they point out a fault or a mistake that I do have, or that I, a mistake that I do, then, okay, I acknowledge it, yeah. But otherwise, why should I get so bent out of shape? You know, it's a free world. They can think what they want. Yeah, and it's only their thoughts. And like I said, you know, they don't really spend their whole lives thinking about what they think about me. Do they? Yeah. Did you think about me during your whole lunch hour? Yeah? You didn't? Oh, my goodness. That's terrible. We've been together the whole weekend and you didn't spend your whole lunch hour thinking about me and talking about me. You know, you really should do that because I'm the center of the universe. Oh, my goodness. Okay. And I look at some people like, you know, the Dalai Lama. You know, we usually look at the Dalai Lama because, you know, we're Buddhist. Oh, he's fantastic and he's wonderful and he's kind and, you know, he's a bodhisattva and he really speaks what's true and he knows. I mean, we're full of praise. We love his holiness. Yeah. But in the eyes of other people, he's the splitter of the motherland. He's the person who destroyed Tibet. He's unreasonable. He's, trying to create a civil war in China, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, two totally different opinions of His Holiness held by two totally different groups. Yeah, so which one is he? And does he wake up in the morning saying, am I a revolutionary trying to create a civil war in China? Or am I a fantastic person that the world loves? Maybe I'm this, maybe I'm that. Hey, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't think he wastes his time thinking about that. Yeah, much better things to do. But like I said, if we have a fault, we should acknowledge it. If we made a mistake, we should acknowledge it. Yeah. But usually when we make a mistake, what do we do? Fight. Usually, first thing we do before we fight, you're accusing, you'd say, I made a mistake. You're wrong. That person made a mistake. And then that person and that person and that person. They made the mistakes, not me. It was because they did blah, 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 blah. But then I had to do blah, 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 blah. So you should go to them and talk to them because I am not at fault. Okay, so we practice the perfection of defensiveness. You know, and we defend ourselves because it's not me, it's other people. Yeah, and it's such an automatic reaction. We talk about this a lot at the Abbey, and I always talk about how people get defensive. Even somebody says something small, you know, like it's your turn to wash dishes. Yeah, that's just a sentence, your turn to wash dishes. Some people go, are you accusing me of not being there to wash the dishes when you think I should be? No, I'm not on the road. That's somebody else who's on it. So don't blame me for not being there. All somebody did was saying, it's your turn to wash the dishes. They weren't accusing you of anything. Yeah? So you can imagine what happens when somebody says, you weren't there when it was your turn to wash the dishes. You know, I thought, what do you mean I wasn't there to wash the dishes? I did my best. I was on my way because I really want to help the community by washing the dishes. And I was on my way to do that. And then somebody else tapped me on the shoulder and they told me that I had left my shoes outdoors and the snow was covering my shoes and I should take them inside. So I went outdoors to get my shoes and on the way I tripped and I broke my leg and that's why I'm late to wash the dishes. You know, they go on with a story for who knows how long. And I'm going, you expect me to believe that? They do seem to expect me to believe it. Okay, so, you know, we have these kinds of habits, don't we? You know, the I is sacrosanct. Don't attack me. Yeah. And this is why the meditation on emptiness is so helpful, because you know, we're so preoccupied with me, but we've never stopped to figure out who I am. Who is the me that you're criticizing? You know, you accuse me of not being there to wash the dishes, which, by the way, is the biggest sin that's going to send you to hell immediately. Yeah, so of course somebody has to comment on it. And of course they tell five other people about it. And then everybody looks at you. You didn't show up when it was your turn to wash the dishes. Oh. Yeah. And then it sets off a whole thing. Yeah, because now everybody's concerned with, well, when I washed the dishes, there were 20 plates, 15 pots and pans, and, 65 forks and spoons and chopsticks. And somebody else goes, well, when I washed the dishes, you know, there were 50 plates and 75 chopsticks and, you know, 104 pots and pans. So I should only have to wash the dishes half as many times as you do because I wash twice as many dishes as you do, you know. And then somebody else says, well, it depends upon how dirty the dishes were. If they're really dirty, you should get more credit for washing them and have to wash fewer dishes. And then somebody else says, you know, well, I wash the dishes no matter what, but some people don't put the previous dishes away. So then I have to put my dishes on top of the dishes that are, my dishes that are wet on top of the dishes that are already dry. And then people complain about that too. You know, so then we have to have a whole community meeting to figure out who washes dishes when, and how many forks and spoons you have to wash, how many, you know, does one pair of chopsticks count as one, like two things, like one fork and one spoon? Or is a pair of chopsticks one thing and comparable only to, you know, that maybe the little spoon, not even a soup spoon, you know, and then it becomes enormous, yeah? And then you spend your days talking about this, trying to solve this humongous problem because it's all got to be fair. Yeah. In America, everything has to be fairer. Yeah. Except for this person and that person, the other one. If you have money, if you have power, you know, then the idea of fair has kind of changed. But for the rest of us peons, you know, we want everything to be fair. Yeah. And we're going to talk about it, make it fair. Can I resign? You know, this is the kind of thing that when you're in charge, it just drives you crazy. Yeah. Okay, so where were we? Yeah, but why are we laughing? Because this is true, isn't it? Yeah? How we have a precious human life with the ability to generate love and compassion for every single sentient being, with the ability to understand the ultimate nature of existence. And how do we spend our time? Figuring out how many forks and spoons, you know, that somebody has to wash. And is a small plate that's really dirty comparable to a big plate that's not dirty? Very dirty. Yeah. Or is a small plate that's really dirty, it counts for more than it counts for two big plates that aren't very dirty. Yeah. One person says one and one person says the other. Okay, let's go forward back to the four establishments of mindfulness. Okay. So when we were talking about the mind, yeah, the individual qualities of the mind, characteristics, are the mind is the observer. The mind is clarity, that which is clear and cognizant. Okay, so the mind doesn't have color, it doesn't have shape, but it exists. So we should stop thinking that the only thing that exists is what we can contact with our five physical senses, because that is not accurate at all. You know, and to say I can't see it with my senses, therefore it doesn't exist, is really rather foolish, because we can't see the inside of our body with our senses, but I think it exists. Yeah. Okay. So the actual nature of the mind, yeah, is pure. It is this pure nature is clouded by the afflictions. Yeah, ignorance, anger, and clinging attachment are the chief ones, but there's 84,000 of them altogether. Okay. And everybody has all 84,000. So I'm really sorry. You do not have 84,001. Yeah. So don't complain about the universe being unfair that you have more afflictions and defilements than everybody else. Yeah. Because we use that as ammunition too for our excuses. Oh, of course I didn't do this because this is wrong and that's wrong. And yeah. Okay. So it's very interesting in doing mindfulness of the mind, too. You can start out with, where is my mind? Yeah. And does it have color? Doesn't have shape? Explore that. Like what is the nature of the mind? And the mind is that which is clear and cognizant. Well, what is clear and cognizant? What does that mean? And what is it about me that makes me clear, you know, that has the characteristics of clarity and cognizance? Is my mind my brain? Can I find my mind inside my brain? Okay. So very interesting to really do mindfulness of the mind and to try and figure out what it is and then observe how it operates. Okay. And then the fourth one is mindfulness of phenomena. So that includes mental factors that all have their own individual natures, as well as permanent phenomena and abstract composites. So of all the phenomena to be mindful of, the mental factors in our own mind are the most important ones. Okay, so you don't need to be mindful of Jupiter's moons. Yeah, I don't know how many moons. How many moons does Jupiter have now? Did it gain some new moons recently? I don't know. We still don't know if Neptune is a planet or not. That's been going on. So, but don't waste your mindfulness on figuring those things out. Okay, look at the mental factors, the different states of mind, the different factors that color or contribute to the cognitive ability of your mind. Okay, so what we do is one way to do mindfulness on the mental factors is to think about the afflictive mental factors and the purified mental factors. Okay, so afflictive ones are ones that disturb the peace of the mind. The afflictive ones, most of them are non-virtuous. Some of them are neutral, but most of them are non-virtuous. And so when we act motivated by an afflictive mental state, anger, resentment, okay, laziness, pretension, deceit, there's so many of them. You know, when we act motivated by that, then we create karma, and then the karma leaves, for about lack of a better description, a seed or an entity, an energy trace on our mind. And then that will ripen and bring about certain results, either in this life or very often in future lives. Okay. So to really look at the different states of mind that we have and be able to discern which are virtuous, which are non-virtuous, and which are neutral. And this is so key to our happiness. Yeah, because we all say, I want happiness and not suffering. So we have to create the cause of happiness. Yeah. And creating the cause for something means doing something before that result happens, because causes always precede results. Yeah. So we can't just wait for happiness to happen, and when it doesn't happen, complain and say, what can I do to fix it? Yeah. Because, for example, once you've broken your leg, you can't undo it. You have to deal with that situation. So the time to create the causes for happiness, okay, is right now. And the happiness we're creating the causes for may be later in this life or most likely future lives. Okay. How did we get the benefits and happiness that we have now? Because whoever we were in a previous life knew what could distinguish what is virtue and what is non-virtue, and could and that person really did their best to live an ethical life, to be generous, to be kind to others, and so on. Okay, so we're living the results of what people in our previous mental continuum did. And we're creating the results for what people in our future mental continuum will experience. Okay. So some people say, but it's not me. In my future life, it's not me. So why should I spend so much time creating causes for future happiness when it's for a different person? Okay. Well, the response to that is, when you are 95 years old, are you the same person as you are now? Are you the same person when you're 95? No, you're a different person. Do you do things now to create the cause of happiness for the who you're going to be when you're 95? Yes. You don't say, oh, the 95-year-old me isn't me. Who cares what happens to that guy? Yeah, you create the causes for happiness. So similarly, whoever we become in a future life is going to be the, you know, in the same mental continuum as we are today. Okay, so when these afflictive mental factors manifest and they accompany the main mind, we have six main minds, yeah? The five that pertain to our senses and our mental consciousness, yeah? So most of these mental factors are going to be ones that pertain to our mental consciousness. Some of them, you know, to our sense consciousnesses too. Okay. So watch in your own mind what kind of thoughts produce clarity in your mind and what kind of thoughts produce confusion or are confusion. Okay, we haven't really stopped to look at that. What kind of thoughts, yeah, build up resentment, and what kind of thoughts pacify resentment? And to do, you know, some study, because the real laboratory is inside here, inside our own mind, yeah. So what mental states are pleasant and create the cause for happiness? Which ones are unpleasant, create the cause for misery? What does it mean to have a pleasant mental state? What does it mean to have an unpleasant one? When our minds are enthralled with some sense object, we might be very happy. Is that a virtuous mental state? Does happiness equal virtue? What about when we are processing something and we or let's say we're meditating on the fact of our own death, that we're mortal. That's a very sobering meditation. You know, you don't come out of that meditation, yippee, I'm gonna die. You know, you come out of that meditation with, okay, death is definite, its time is indefinite, and what is really important is my Dharma practice, not money and possessions and reputation and so on. Okay, so it's a very sobering meditation. Is your mind in one way calmer and clearer then? Are you more able to make wise decisions then? Yeah. Or sometimes when we're really happy over the moon with, you know, oh, wonderful. Do you make really stupid decisions? Yeah. Sometimes we do. It's not only, you know, hurt that makes us do stupid things. Sometimes too much happiness, we do really stupid things. Okay. I hope you don't mind me saying we do stupid things. Some people get offended, but I'm including myself in it. Okay. And we do stupid things, don't we? Yeah. I mean, how many of you are parents? Really? Not some of you aren't? Okay. When you're parents, my goodness, you're trying to educate your child so they don't do stupid things, aren't you? But sometimes you watch yourself and you do the same stupid thing. Yeah? Parents always tell their kids, don't listen to peer pressure. Just because your friends are doing it, it doesn't mean you have to do it. You think for yourself. You know what's right and what's wrong, and don't just follow what everybody else is doing. You say to your children, right? Yeah? And that's good advice for a kid. Then, what do you do? Yeah? You watch what all your friends are doing, and then you try and do the same thing. Just after you got done telling your kids not to listen to peer pressure. Okay? So, to be able, when we can notice these things in our mind, it gives us so much information that is really helpful to helping us slow down and really think about things and not act so impetuously. How many of you make very impetuous decisions? Oh, of course, no. Oh, one person admits it. Two, three, four people admit it. Five. Okay, that's all. Nobody else here makes impetuous decisions. I know you're all cool-headed. You examine things very well. Your minds are clear, no affliction, and you always make good decisions, right? Yeah, right. we have to really look at what we do. In doing this, I'll give you some examples. What I discovered is in meetings, if we're discussing something and somebody says something that I think is a really bad idea, I feel like I've got to immediately step in and denounce that idea and say why it's wrong and nobody should believe it. Because if I don't do that, all these other people are going to be tricked and they're going to believe this wrong idea. So I've got to step in and correct everything. Okay. And so I often step in and try and correct things. That goes over really big. But what I've learned in slowing down and noticing this, because when I think something needs to be corrected, I've got to say the very next word. I cannot wait 15 seconds. I've got to interrupt and right away say how that idea is just pernicious. It's horrible. But what I've discovered is very often, if I don't comment on somebody else's idea, nobody else does either, and it automatically fades away. So I don't really need to interrupt the meeting to dispense with somebody's wrong idea. It will just naturally fade away. If it continues, for a long time in the meeting, then I can add my opinion. But the world is not going to fall apart immediately if I don't correct something. Yeah. So it was a good thing to become aware of. Because when you're the person who always interrupts and says, oh, that idea is terrible, you not so many people are really fond of that behavior. Okay, so it's good to have this kind of mindfulness of, you know, how I am influenced by different mental states and what causes that, what's the result of that, you know. Relating to the question about dignity, if somebody said something very insulting to me, yeah, then it's not just an insult, you know, like, you have a big nose. Okay, I know I have a big nose. Yeah, and I know the world knows I have a big nose. Yeah. Well, so why do you need to comment on it? So, you know, it starts out, you have a big nose, and then our mind takes it and goes around with it. He said, I have a big nose. What's the size of their nose? Are they jealous because my nose is big and they have a tiny nose? Are they putting me down because I have a big nose? Are they discriminating against me, thinking I'm Pinocchio or somebody? You know, what's going on in their mind? And they said it in front of a bunch of people, and now everybody's looking at my nose. Oh, what am I going to do? What do these people think of me? Yeah, I am more than my nose. Can't you see I'm a good person behind this nose? You know, how our mind takes one small thing and goes around and around and around in circles about it. Yeah? And what do they have against big noses anyway? Yeah, that's often used as a way to insult certain ethnic groups. Are you insulting me because of what my ethnic group is? Now, who do you think you are? You know? And my goodness, our mind just spins out over somebody saying one small thing. Okay. Now, let's say they really did intend to hurt my feelings. Oh, you know, you really have a king-size nose. Yeah, you'll never make it in Hollywood with that nose. Yeah. They want to hurt my feelings. Well, you know, okay, you have a big nose. I won't make it in Hollywood. Actually, I don't want to make it in Hollywood. Good. You know, I don't have to interpret that as somebody thinks I'm worthless, useless, bad, you know, incapable. Do you see what I mean when I say we have a choice about how we're going to feel? You know, and it depends on how we interpret the external events. And we often really misinterpret things and build one thing on another and another and another. Okay, so I'm giving you some silly examples, but I bet you can find some ones in your own life that, you know, because we misinterpreted things and built them up, that created a lot of problems. Okay, so examine the nature, causes, function, and result. Starting with the three poisonous minds, ignorance, anger, and attachment. Okay, so what is their nature? Yeah, what are they? How do they function? What makes them arise? Yeah, and what's the result of them arising? And is there a way to subdue them? Okay, so these kind of questions to really, you know, when you're sitting in meditation, you're really observing this and investigating. So, I forgot to mention this very important point. When we talk about mindfulness in Buddhism, mindfulness is itself a mental factor, and it is very closely related to wisdom. So in the four establishments of mindfulness, we're not just observing something. We're observing these four things with wisdom, to increase our wisdom. And when we can observe things like this deeply, yeah, and since what we're observing are the basic constituents of who we are, our body, our mind, our feelings, all the different mental factors. Since these are the basic constituents of what we are, this kind of mindfulness leads us into the wisdom realizing emptiness. Because we're investigating, you know, who we are, what are the parts that make us up. Yeah. And that's very important because the root of all of our dukkha is a misunderstanding of who we are and how we exist. Okay, so I'm really want to emphasize this point because mindfulness is a big buzzword now in society. There's mindful everything. Somebody contacted me a few weeks ago for an interview. They have some radio show about eating and food, and they wanted to interview me to know about mindful eating. What in the world is mindful eating? Yeah. They had some idea of what it was. I wasn't quite sure what they were talking about. Yeah. Mindful eating could mean a bunch of different things. Couldn't it? It could be your motivation for eating, what you eat, how you prepare it, do you eat with others? I mean, there's so many things. Yeah. So now everything is mindful, you know. Mindfully complaining. I do that one very well. Yeah, really, it's my specialty, complaining. Yeah, if you ever need a complaint, contact me. I can come up with one for you, free of charge. Yeah, and I can think of new creative things to complain about that nobody else has complained about before. So what we hear in mindfulness and society, I don't, you know, and there's apps now to learn mindfulness, and you can have your app, you know, so you can have, you'd be all plugged in, and there's mindful music to listen to, and pictures to watch to create mindfulness, and everything's mindful now. I don't know what mindful means in that context anymore. Okay. But the idea of mindfulness came from Buddhism. But in secular society, it's got stretched here and there and everywhere. Okay. John Kabat-Zinn, many years ago, maybe 30, 40 years ago, started developing mindfulness in terms of helping people with chronic pain. So he took Buddhist mindfulness and kind of addressed it, made it like a mindfulness of the body, but you're mindful of your pain, how it comes and goes and arises. And it really helped a lot of people. It still does. He's still teaching it. Okay, but then after that, it's like mindfulness in the corporation, mindfulness in the financial world, I don't know what it means. Yeah. Because some people take it as mindful just means being aware of what you're doing. Okay? So I'm mad at somebody. I'm mindful that I'm mad at them. I'm mindful that I'm lifting up my hand. I'm mindful that my fist just clenched. I'm mindful that my arm is going towards the other person. I'm mindful that the fist goes into their face. Excuse me? Is this mindfulness? Yeah? It doesn't mean just being aware of what we're doing. Yeah? So I advocate keeping secular mindfulness in the secular world and Buddhist mindfulness in the Buddhist world, and not to confuse them, okay? Secular mindfulness, some of how it's done is very good and people find it very helpful. Yeah, so that's fine. But they shouldn't confuse it with what the Buddha taught. Yeah, because what the Buddha taught is helping us. The ultimate goal is to steer us toward realizing the nature of reality so that we can be free of samsara. Yeah. Secular mindfulness is steered at being more relaxed. What's it steered at? Yeah, I'm not quite sure. For some people making the apps, maybe it's steered at making money. Yeah. But like I said, some people teach it and it's really quite helpful. Yeah. So some reasons why I think don't confuse it with Buddhism is because the secular mindfulness can be taught to anybody. They don't have to be Buddhist, and people shouldn't confuse it with Buddhism, because then some people who could benefit from secular mindfulness won't even go to the courses because they're afraid that somebody will try and convert them. So that's not so good. Yeah. On the other hand, they shouldn't be confused, because people who learn secular mindfulness should not think that now I understand the Buddha's teachings, or that now I'm qualified to teach Buddhism, because they're not, okay? So I just feel that that's something to throw into the discussion about mindfulness. And we're Buddhists, so we're doing it, the practice, for a specific reason. Yeah. Okay. Now, okay, so then there's a section on the reason for meditation on the four kinds of mindfulness. Okay, so the long-term reason, you know, is to lead one to understand very clearly what is to be practiced on the path and what is to be abandoned on the path. And you hear this very often, you know, what to practice and what to abandon. And it's incredibly important if when we practice the Dharma that we should know what is the Buddha saying to practice and develop, what is he saying to quit? Okay. Because if you get it confused, I have the hiccups again. If you get it confused, then you can wind up creating a lot of non-virtue. Yeah. And so there have been some scandals in Buddhism, in the Buddhist world. And I think this often happens because people either are not aware of their own actions, the causes they aren't aware of their feelings and their body and their mental factors. So being unaware of what's making them tick, they just do whatever. That can be harmful. And other people are confused about what to practice and what to abandon and think that what they're doing may be virtue when in fact it's non-virtue. Okay, so this part is really quite important because preserving the Dharma for future generations is important. And the Buddha said, and I really believe this is true, is the Dharma is not destroyed by outside people. The Dharma is destroyed by inside corruption. Yeah, when people do not practice properly. So this is why, you know, we need to be attentive because we all want the Dharma to continue so that other people can really benefit from these teachings. Yeah. Because there's nothing like these teachings anywhere else on this planet. Okay. Then the question arises, how do these four mindfulnesses help us gain a deeper understanding of the four truths? So I often say four truths instead of four noble truths, because the word noble, I don't think is a good translation for the word Arya. Yeah. The idea was that these are noble beings. The Aryas are noble beings because they've overcome ignorance. But noble also means like a noble cause or noble like royalty. And if the first two are dukkha and the cause of dukkha, what in the world is noble about either of those? Yeah. So it's actually, instead of noble, we should say Arya. And then it's the four things that are true for Aryas. Aryas being beings who have seen the nature of reality. Okay. But I just now say the four truths. So you have to fill in the rest. So I'm explaining that so you don't get confused. Okay, so how do the four mindfulnesses help us gain a deeper understanding of the four truths? Okay, well, first of all, they counteract the four distortions. Okay, so the four distortions are specifically apply to the first truth, yeah, through dukkha, yeah, in that we think impermanent things are permanent, things that are foul are pure, things that are unsatisfactory are satisfactory and good, and things that lack a self have a self. Yeah. So we talked about this yesterday, remember, and how each one of those four conceptions applies to one of the four objects of mindfulness. Okay, so so we'll clearly, as we meditate on the four, we come to really clearly understand the disadvantages of samsara, and then that leads us to the aspiration to be free of samsara. And that aspiration is a must, because if we don't want to be free of samsara, then there's nothing to motivate us to create the causes to be free from samsara. Okay, so we have to see the defects of samsara and just really think, you know, this isn't worth tweaking. I can't tweak it. I want to get off this merry-go-round. Okay, I want to stop being reborn again and again and again under the power of afflictions and karma. Okay. And when you have that determination, then practice becomes so much easier. You're not distracted by things. Yeah. You're really clear on what you want. And so whoever won the World Cup, you don't care. You know, it's like whoever won, you're glad that they're happy. Whoever lost, you hope they will have happiness from something else. But you don't sit there and in front of the tube all day. Oh, goodness, look, he kicked the ball. Oh, look, that guy kicked the ball back in the other direction. Yeah, I have to excuse myself because I know some people in this room, for them, where a ball is really important. Yeah. For my dad, you know, where the ball was on the weekends, yeah, it depended whether it was a football, a baseball, a golf ball, a tennis ball. You know, that was really important. Where is the ball? And somehow I grew up with that appreciation of where balls are. Yeah, I know it's a fault. So, you know, but really, you know, when you think about it, is it really important who has a ball? You think so? You are nodding your head, yes. Yeah, I mean, really, some people, they go totally bananas over who has the ball. We were in, where was it, Indonesia, when they were having a soccer something. Yeah, and remember the noise whenever the Indonesian team scored a point. Rah! You know, it's like, okay, we, you know. So, excuse me if I make fun of what is of incredible importance and interest to you. Okay. Yeah, but when you want to get free of samsara, it's like, you know, it really doesn't matter who caught the ball, who kicked the ball, where it is. Okay. Yeah. So, through meditating on the establishment of mindfulness on the body, we'll come to know that the polluted body has the nature of karmically produced dukkha. That doesn't sound very optimistic, does it? You know, that our body is the product of, well, our body has dukkha, or is dukkha, and that dukkha, that unsatisfactoriness, that suffering and misery, is a product of our karma. And we're the ones who created that karma. Okay. When we meditate on the mindfulness of the body, that becomes much clearer. And our whole way of relating to our body becomes much more realistic, much calmer. You know, you don't worry so much about how you look. Yeah, you don't worry if people see you that wear those same clothes before. Yeah. You don't worry about how many wrinkles you have. You just know you have more than you did before. But you don't worry about it, you know, because your mind is really more tuned into, I don't want to take this kind of body again in the future. Yeah, I want to purify my mind so that the kind of body I take in the future is a body that can really be a benefit to sentient beings, so that I can manifest different bodies according to the needs of sentient beings. Also through meditating on the mindfulness of the body, we'll see that the body is the first noble truth. The body is dukkha. Yeah. And we see all the problems associated with the body and all of its defects. But we don't get discouraged and hateful towards the body. We have it, we use it to create virtue as we aspire to have a body with that is taken by a mind that is free of afflictions. Okay. Through meditating on the establishment of mindfulness on the feelings, we will understand that the feeling of pleasure is the cause for the craving that desires not to be separated from whatever the object is. Do you ever have really strong craving for something? Yeah. It's like you're just sitting there. And it's like, I want this now. Yeah. And it's not just pregnant women wanting pickles, you know, at midnight. It's not that kind of craving. It's, you know, I want this. And this, only this will make me happy. I had a friend in high school who wanted a Porsche. Yeah. He wanted a Porsche so badly. All through high school, we were friends, and all he would talk about was the Porsche he wanted to get when he was older and had enough money, or the Porsche he wished his dad would give him now, but that wasn't going to happen. For me, cars and balls are kind of in the same racket. The way I discriminate cars is by this one's yellow and this one's red and this one's black. I cannot discern a Chevy from a V-Dub, from a Beamer. This is beyond my pay grade. Okay. But for him, that was so important. You know, for him that the car, you know, indicated something. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it was at 16 and 17 years old that car represented, but he wanted it. Anyway, yeah, fast forward, he finished school, he worked, he bought his Porsche. Bliss. For about a month. And then he got tired of it and didn't bring him happiness anymore. And I forget what he wanted after that, because we, you know, he moved one place, I moved another place. Okay. But, you know, if you watch how feelings produce craving and you work hard to get what you want and then stop and say, does getting what I want make me happy? This object that I wanted so badly, yeah, does it make me really, truly happy? Very interesting. I'm sure we all had lots of objects in our life that we really wanted, right? Did any of them bring you true happiness? If they did, you would now be with that object. You wouldn't be here in this room. Yeah. If something that you craved before really fulfilled your desire for happiness, you would still be with it. But after a while, that object, it breaks. It's out of fashion. We're tired of it. It's boring. Okay. also through meditating on mindfulness of feelings, we'll understand that the feeling of pain is the cause for craving that desires to be separate from pain. Get this cushion away. It doesn't make my rear end feel happy. You know, and you just get fixated on something. Okay. Also, by mindfulness on the feelings, we begin to understand how feelings are the source of a lot of our dukkha. How we're just captivated and held hostage by the craving that wants something, or the craving to be free of something. You know, that kind of craving just takes over our mind, and we don't have a lot of mental freedom then. Okay, meditating on mindfulness of the mind. Okay, we come to understand that the mind is impermanent, and that, we will also cease to conceive of the mind as ourself. Yeah, we'll cease to grasp the mind as the person. Mm-hmm. And also by meditating on mindfulness of the mind, we will be motivated to attain the third of the four truths, true cessation. Okay, so true cessation is the realization of the nature of reality, and it's also the cessation of the first two truths, true dukkha and true cause of dukkha. So that comes from meditating on mindfulness of the mind. Okay. And also, so mindfulness of the mind helps to understand true cessation, because you get rid of the fear that I will cease to exist. Okay. So most people who fear death fear it because they're afraid the I, the self, will cease. But when we know that we are not our mind, then we cease to be afraid of going out of existence when we die. Yeah, because we know that the mind is changing, it is impermanent, it will continue on to future lives. So we know there's a continuity of mind. Yeah, so we know that the mind, which is important to us, does not cease. But we also know that we are not the mind. And in fact, we can't find anything that we can draw a circle around and say, that is who I am. So if we can't find any kind of independent I or me or self, then we don't have to worry about such a self dying. Okay, because something doesn't exist, that doesn't exist, cannot go out of existence. Yeah. And an independent I, an inherently existent I, has never existed. So when we see that, because right now our mind is ignorant and we think that there is an independent I, something that really is me. But when we check and we analyze it, we can't pinpoint anything. Okay? So, for example, somebody criticizes you. You disappointed me. You really botched up that job. Who are they criticizing? You say, oh, they're criticizing me. Who are you? What are you? But what part of you is getting hurt when they say you broke, you know, you botched up this job and they're disappointed in you? Who's hurt? Is it your body that's hurt? Is it your mind that's hurt? Is it something else beside that is not your body and mind that is hurt? Who did that person insult when they said you disappointed me? Yeah? Yeah? Who did they insult? When you look, it's like, well, they didn't insult my body because saying, you know, that I botched up a job, that's not my body. Yeah. They didn't really insult my mind because my mind is just, you know, it's thinking and feeling and cognizing. How can you insult a mind? Yeah. And there's nothing aside from the body and mind that is me. Even though I think there is, that is the tricky one. You know, we either think that we are some part of the body and mind, or that there's something separate that is me. If there's something separate that is me, what in the world is it? Well, I saw this movie, and in the movie, the guy died, and this kind of amorphous shape came out of him and went over here and went into the dog's body. So that's who you are? You're an amorphous shape? So somebody insulted an amorphous shape? I don't think that's who you are. It's quite interesting to really investigate this. Hmm? Okay. So also by overcoming the idea that the mind is the self, we won't be afraid to try to attain cessation. And this is because we won't think that the mind is the self and that, you know, because often when people are afraid of death, you know, okay, they don't want to leave their wealth. They don't want to leave their body. They don't want to leave their social status. They don't want to leave their friends. But the real deepest fear I think people have of death is that I will cease to exist totally. Okay. And what do they base that on? Well, the body ceases, so the person must cease. Or the mind disappears. We don't know. There's no consciousness left. So it must mean the person also ceased. And that fear of not existing, I think, is one of the biggest fears people have of death. Whereas, if we know that we are not the mind, but still there's a continuity of mind, and that continuity actually is the basis of designation for I, although it isn't me, then we stop being afraid of dying. So we know the mind continues, even though we aren't the mind. Okay. And so when we know that there's no danger that the mind will discontinue, then we aren't afraid to try to attain true cessation. Because some people get afraid of ceasing their samsara, because if I am not a samsaric being, if that has ceased, then I don't exist. So they're very reluctant to practice the, you know, understand the wisdom realizing emptiness or practice to attain true cessations. Okay. By meditating on mindfulness of phenomena, we will engage in the true path. The true path is the fourth truth. Okay. So the true path is all the realizations that we need to gain that will overcome the true causes of dukkha. And when that's overcome, we attain the true cessation, which is the cessation of true dukkha. Okay, so the first two truths, true dukkha and its causes, are to be abandoned, and the last two, true cessations, true paths, are to be gained. Okay. So meditating on phenomena will engage in the true path, because we will recognize that the afflictive phenomena are to be abandoned and the purified phenomena are to be cultivated, and that the purified mental factors are the antidote that overcome the afflictive mental factors. So we begin to basically get an understanding of how liberation and enlightenment are possible. And when you have that understanding, then you really want to practice. You are very optimistic, because you know that dukkha can be removed because its causes can be overcome. And so your life becomes very purposefully and meaningful. And I think that sense of purpose and meaning brings great joy. Yeah. Even we haven't accomplished the path yet, we're so fortunate to have encountered it. We're so fortunate to have the opportunity to even practice it a little bit. And so that brings great confidence and joy in the mind. Yeah, here and now. And then, of course, we create the causes for happiness in the future. So, I think, I haven't gone through everything, but I think that's good enough. Okay, good point to end. So please, go over what you've learned and think about it. You know, don't let it be in one ear and out the other, but really try and ponder these things. If you've forgotten, what they are, I or somebody else can give you a copy of this text and you can use it as an outline. You have it? Yeah. What? It's on our website. Oh, okay. That's easy. And then there's also the teachings, the video teachings that you can watch. Yeah. But this is really a very, I think, a very special practice.